hit it off here. So yeah, hi, this is another edition of Insert Buzzword. Today we are not recording with Hagen, first time without him. I'm today with DK Panda from Ohio State University. You're a professor there for...
Now 26 years.
Okay, so that's a long time.
Yes.
But before we jump in, I have some housekeepings that I would like to talk about. So as I said, first podcast without Hagen, already marked out. And today we are introducing some HPC topics into the podcast. And I will create markers. So if you have a podcatcher that supports chapters, then you should use it and have a look at it. So if one topic is not to your pleasing, then you can just skip it. Or if you want to hear it again, this little section, then you can go back in time, basically. So check if your podcaster or podcatcher uses or makes use of chapters, and then you can skip around. Okay, but and I will do a chapter mark now. So DK, maybe a little introduction of where you're coming from. Why yeah. HPC? Why Ohio State?
Okay. I mean, so I've been working in this area now for almost 25, 30 years. If we consider my PhD program also. My objective is mainly has been on the parallel processing side. How do we run things faster? That is the main goal. And within that framework, we also try to make sure that things run faster, and especially focusing on the communication aspects and all the related networking and things. So we used to work on all the older networks like the Mirinet, Quadrix, IBM, SP. And since early 2000, you saw there is a change in the directions. InfiniBand came into the market. And since that time, we have been continuously working on trying to take advantage of all the InfiniBand networking technologies, the RDMA technologies, and its applicability to all other networks like the Rocky, IWARP, and even recently also the Omnipath. Mm-hmm. So all these networks, we are able to take advantage of all the features and try to see how to push these features and mechanisms and the benefits to the upper layers so that the applications can just take the benefits.
But why? Why 25 years ago, 30 years ago, what was the attraction that you had? It was just something that your university did where you were at the university and then you just kept going with it?
I was fascinated to the field of parallel processing in my graduate studies. So in my PhD program, I actually focused on how you can design good networks mm-hmm. so that you can have efficient communication, mm-hmm. parallel communication. So that was the background. And that is where I just started.
And then you kept going.
Yeah. Yes.
And you collected a lot of graduates now, PhDs.
Yes.
That you have your famous wall of heroes, I think. Oh, how do you call it again? I think, was the, it wall of heroes? No.
The rock star.
The rock star. Yeah.
Rock star of the HPC.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Cool.
Okay. Thank you.
And so maybe we then after this, we can just start with HPC in general. So as I said, this is the 12th podcast of this series, so to speak. And we are never talked about HPC, even though I dropped it every once in a while. So maybe if we could have a little brief overlook of what HPC is, maybe where it came from, like in the 30s, or in the 30s, but 50s, 60s, yeah. 70s.
Yeah, I think it's the HPC stands for high performance computing. So that means if you have an application and on a sequential processor, let's say it takes X amount of time. So the question is, can we try to parallelize it or take advantage of any other things like the multi-cores, CAS architecture, or the storage system to make it faster. Mm-hmm. Single job. So that is the whole idea. That single job, we should be able to run much more faster. That mm-hmm. is the background of high-performance computing.
Yeah, and so you want to build a house, and you have one brick layer, and if you can have five brick layers, then you can build it five times as fast.
Faster, but not five times. But that is the idea.
Yeah.
But nobody can achieve the real ideal things because there is a lot of communication overhead, even algorithmic overhead. So eventually, you get up to certain extent in the parallel speed up, but may not be 100% it, unless the job is inherently parallel.
But then, then you can split it up once.
Once, and then you push it out, and then you can combine it.
Yeah.
Sure.
It sounds if you talk like brick layers, and that's very, very easy to explain, right? You cannot build one house with 1,000 brick layers because they will talk more than they lay bricks, right? So, and this is the whole notion of HPC, or that's achieving most of out of one host, basically, right? So I heard once at a HPC conference, and that resonates with me, that the barrier everyone wants to beat is the memory bandwidth, because you cannot get faster than this on one single host, right? And once you achieve this, then you try to take it to the next host. But and I think this distinguish the other IT disciplines, at least for me, all the time, because HPC tries to squeeze as much out of one host and tries to stay away from paralyzing it, and because it's easier on one host because you don't have the overhead, right? So
there are multiple aspects. So basically, for a given job, you have some amount of data on which you are doing the processing. So where the data sits? If the data can sit in the memory of one node completely, then you just go and try to access all the data. But then the memory bandwidth may come into the picture, mm-hmm. like how fast you are able to access the memory, or computation to memory access ratios. And gradually what is happening, all application scientists want to operate on larger data, more finer grain simulations. So you cannot fit everything into the single node. So in that case, you have to extend the processing to some other nodes. Yeah. And then the question is how efficiently you do the communication.
Yeah. Okay. And there is a sweet spot, right? I remember back in my automotive days that our customer was always only using 8 nodes, no matter the core count. And he said, I don't know whether he read it somewhere or someone told him, but he said, okay, we have 8 nodes, and no matter how many core counts we have, then this is the package that an engineer should use, because they said that's the most efficient way of processing.
It totally depends on the application.
Yeah, true.
And the how much fraction of that application is sequential and how much can be parallelized. So we have the classic Amdahl's law. So Amdahl's law says that if you have this percentage of things which cannot be parallelized, then there is a limit on which what is the maximum parallel speed up you can achieve. And so might be that person you are referring, for that application domain, it was like 8.
If someone takes like a bucket of water to someone who wants to make lemonade, and there's only one guy taking the bucket out, then this guy cannot be paralyzed, right?
That's
so
true.
If you have only a sink where you can get one bucket on, so that's the sequential path that you cannot
paralyze.
You can make lemonade as fast as you want, you
that's
won't
true.
Get this too. Okay, cool. Yeah. And maybe the little or the last 30 years in 2 minutes or so. So from my perspective, and maybe you just jump in when I talk bullshit. I mean, in the 70s, 80s, and beginning of the 90s, it was the highest discipline of IT. Is it fair to say? I mean, that was the spearhead of of innovations because no one had the problems to really throw a lot of money out on a problem and innovate on it. And the weather forecasts and the nuclear fusion reaction, whatever simulations, they were the problems that needed to be solved. And governments spent money like
yes. Yeah, those were called grand challenge problems.
Yeah.
So once they defined the grand challenge problems, so then the community started looking at how really we can accelerate these applications from hardware perspective, programming models, compilers, operating systems. So the whole area started growing.
Yeah. And then in 96, there was a remarkable, I think, a landmark when the first Linux commodity cluster came out, Bearwolf, right? In 96, yeah. I think, with, I don't know, not much nodes, right? 12 or so? Kind of.
I don't remember the exact one, but it was but a
it
small
was
not,
it
small
was long. In the two digits, I think.
Yes.
And yeah, and since then, Linux commodity clusters are on the rise.
Yes.
And they dominate now, right? As That's they correct. Do in normal cloud computing, I guess.
Yes.
Everything is Linux. Everything is x86, even though that's
other platforms are there.
Yeah, they are gaining a foothold momentum. Somehow. Yes. I mean, the top two are... Oh, no, the first one is the Chinese one, right? It's not x86.
They have their own processor.
Yeah.
They have their own processor.
Yeah, and even they kicked out the Knight's Landing. Oh, no, those were fun on the second one, right? Anyway, but yeah. But they were overtaken a little bit by the non... HPC cloud, I guess, in terms of throwing money at things.
Yeah, so broadly, if you see, there are HPC application or workloads. There are also the typical data center workload, like let's say the typical banking, insurance, even our typical Google. So there is a lot of those kind of applications. Sometimes you may not see, but each of those applications can also take advantage of HPC,
yeah.
but not in a big manner.
Yeah.
It might have some limited parallelism. And these days, even a single, let's say KKNL has 68 cores.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have a job running on a single node with exploiting all the 68 cores, it itself is a HPC application.
Yeah, and at AWS, you can now, I think, get 144 cores.
Yes.
Like a virtual machine with 144
cores.
You can do a lot with this amount of cores, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you have only your housewife's problems, like not the big things. Yeah.
That's right.
So we commoditized over the last 20 years, more or less, give or take. And we commoditized or we consolidated on x86. And in the 80s and 90s, beginning of the 90s, there were a lot of coprocessors around, right? Mm-hmm. And now we are getting back to coprocessors, right?
Yes.
So the history repeats itself.
Yeah. So that is very interesting. So that time, what was happening, if you go back even the Intel 8085, this is in, I'm talking about, I think, in early 80s. There was 8085 processor. Then they had a 8086 coprocessor. Mm-hmm. So the idea was that the main processor should not be very complicated and it should be general purpose. But if some applications need something extra, in those cases like floating point operations, they used to do that in the 8086. So that's how the thing started over the years, 8085, 8086. Then I think it was 8286, 386. So like this. A lot of these processors came.
And was it why, I mean, just out of, it pops in my head, but was it that the instruction set was not as complicated as it is today? So you needed to have different processors with different instruction sets to do it?
It was the limitation of transistors. You see, that time, you cannot put too many transistors inside a single chip.
Yeah.
So they were able to separate it out, but at the same time, they had very tight integration. So if you see 8085 and 8086, in fact, there used to be 8-bit lines, 16-bit lines. It was very tightly coupled, but just decoupled into two different chips.
So it's a a more zoomed in thing that we have today, where we have one ship that has a lot of processors and a lot of groups.
Yes.
And if you want to lit up like an Xeon, if you would lit up everything that's on the ship, then it will just burn, right? Because the system on a ship is just overloaded and cannot sustain the heat.
It is going back and forth. So in the early 90s, we saw the number of transistors can keep on increasing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you see in the early 90s, processors became much more faster. Every 6 months, the processor speed was doubling. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, that time, people thought that the parallel computing is dead. because each processor can do so faster. So why do I need additional processors?
Yeah.
But then what happens, there was the heat consumption problem came. So that means people kept on finding it out that you cannot keep on adding more and more transistors without consuming more power.
Yeah. How was this law again?
This is the traditional, the Moore's law.
Yeah, but there was a heat law. I forgot that the power density will stay the same on the same area somehow.
I'm not able to recollect, but there could be something.
Okay, but then they hit the 4 gigahertz wall, right?
Yes.
So that was not handleable anymore.
Yes.
It was too brittle.
Yeah, so that was the time. Again, it took a deflection point. So the deflection was, instead of putting all the transistors for a single processor, can I divide those into multiple cores? So it can be still be single chip, but within that chip, I have replicated the multiple cores, and that led to all the recent innovations, whatever we are seeing. It's because transistor real estate point of view, we can have a lot of transistors in a single chip, but they need not be for a single processor.
Mm-hmm.
They can be used for multiple processors.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the new name is core.
Mm-hmm.
There is a chip, then there are more cores.
Mm-hmm.
So we are seeing the growth from in the beginning, if you remember, it was called Core Duo.
Yeah.
The two cores.
Now
we have reached even commodity Broadwell, we have 14 cores, 16 cores, Canon has 68 cores.
Yeah.
So very soon we'll see almost 128, 256 cores
yeah.
per chip. It will be coming.
This is because the integration can be so tiny now. I mean, we are now at 12 nanometers or
yes.
14 nanometers.
It is going down.
And they have so much real estate
yes.
that they have to put something in there.
That's correct. That's
kind
correct.
Of.
Yeah, I mean, it's in both ways. It is not just duplicating the cores, but each core also these days have very advanced pipelining, all the multi-threading. So they
branch prediction and all
branch
this
prediction, jazz. More caches, more layers of caches. So all those things try to make a single core go faster, but at the same time you also have multiple cores.
Mm-hmm.
So might be in another 2 years we'll see each of our laptop has 100 cores.
Yeah. Ah. I don't know what to do with 100 cores.
That's correct.
But
that's
do you think
correct.
That there will be somehow an inflection point where we say, okay, this x86 instruction kit is so complex now, or do you think that it will prevail and it will keep on growing?
I think x86 will continue. There is so much investment has taken on the code. You can always change the hardware, but always you need to provide a backward compatibility so that the older applications can run.
Yeah.
But then the next phase, whatever is coming, you might be seeing is called systems on chip,
mm-hmm.
SoC, or networks on chip, NOC. So besides focusing the transistors for purely registers, CAS, now they are trying to expand so that the entire system can be put it into a single chip.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the next phase, which is coming.
And then you have tiny, tiny devices. And I mean, now we are pivoting a little bit to how computing is done. I was just about to say, that if we look at the square kilometer array and all these new projects, which has like dozens, not dozens, thousands and millions of little sources of information, which needs to be processed, like also the CERN, the particle accelerator, how was it called? Never mind. But it has a lot of experiments where a lot of data is created, and then you need to decide what should I keep.
Sure.
And this is then mostly done with in the ingest point, so that you try to trigger an event, and then you make an event-driven computing, which is then processing it down, and at the end you have a little extraction of what you really need. Do you see this also being more and more predominant in the computing industry? I mean, at Kafka and Hadoop.
Kind of
workloads.
The field is moving into those directions, like the square kilometer array or the CERN. These are the leading examples. But you can also take smaller examples, like an image coming from an MRI machine or an X-ray or some data coming from sensors from a city. So all the places, I think people are moving the processing to the closer to the data and then do some kind of pre-processing, and so that the next step involves only processing the required or the needed data.
That you bring the compute to the data where it's created, and you do not need to centralize it first and then do processing with
but,
it.
But you can think of like it's a two-phase or a multi-phase computation. The first phase, you are trying to do only pre-processing because that time each data is local and you are just doing the local computation without knowing the results or the data of the other computations.
Yeah.
But then as you go in the hierarchy, this is where you need to establish some correlation, trying to find out pattern. This is where the deep learning kind of things heading. And then once you, and there of course you need HPC, all the big data, all kinds of challenges are there. But then people are also thinking, can you steer the acquisition of the data?
Yeah.
So it's a feedback kind of things.
Just also like a little endeavor of my mind. The HPC community was very close for like decades, I guess, fair to say, right? And then the commoditization brought all the goodness of economy of scale, and the processors were cheaper. And then the Googles and Facebook, they catched up on the technology because they had the need of the high endurance and good quality and reliability and speed of the HPC products. But the old HPC crowd was still there, like the weather forecasters or the physicists doing physics simulation.
Yes.
And now the crowd of previously maybe not so HPC like guys, they are here and moving the community a little bit towards more big data workloads. And the weather forecast guys, they're still standing where they stood for like 30 years ago, and all this youngsters comes around and then they come around and they move the field a little bit. Do you think some are like reluctant, or like do you think that they are puzzled how this field shifted? Or
no, it's a HPC, as you see the benefits, more and more people are thinking a little bit creatively, and that is good for HPC. That is good for HPC because these are newer domains which are opening up, and the hardware and the low-level software stacks are again the same. Whether you are running a commodity cluster with might be a high-speed Ethernet, whether it is there in a weather forecasting cluster or a big data cluster or a deep learning cluster, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So it is just the application characteristics and domains are changing. Of course, it has its own challenges to design the underlying runtime. Just to give an example, like let's say the traditional MPI based applications were all optimized for small to medium SSDs. But now the deep learning when they talk about like media messages, it is like hundreds of kilobytes, not 100 bytes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that means the underlying runtime has to be modified or redesigned to satisfy those kind of applications.
Mm. And maybe pivoting into this area a little bit, what distinguished or what has distinguished, at least to my knowledge, I think, or the non-HPC from the HPC world was that non-HPC was always TCP, right? So, and with TCP, I mean, you guys hopefully know it, or otherwise maybe not. You have a lot of layers, and for each layer, for each transformation, you need to look into the kernel and do most of the processing there, and this slows you down, right? That's why TCP has an effective rate of 75%, because you are always trying to send more, then you fall back to 20, yeah, to 75, and then you go up again, or was it back to 60 somehow? But it was not as fast as the bandwidth of the medium could ever be, right? Because it has ever always a limitation. But for non-HPC workloads, this was not a bottleneck. And for HPC workload, it was. And we cope with it using HPC interconnects, right? And this is what your field of expertise, mm-hmm, is, right? So the InfiniBands, as you said, the Myrinets, which I worked with, like, briefly, mm-hmm, back then. But it was mostly InfiniBand. And InfiniBand started in the...
October 2000, yeah, when the InfiniBand specification, the first specification came out.
Yeah,
it has been almost 17 years.
Yeah, and it gets rid of all the layers, basically, and just goes from layer A to, oh no, layer 2?
Yeah. So, let's think it from a different perspective. So, as we discussed earlier, like high-performance computing is dependent on like parallelization. So, think of a group of people in a project, like working together. Obviously, there will be some communication between these people working in a team. Now, the question is, as the project increases, let's say there is a 5-team project versus a 500 members project, obviously the 500 members project will have a lot of communication demand.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if we cannot solve that communication demand properly, then most of the people will be remaining idle and not will be able to make progress.
Mm-hmm. And this was related to the upcoming or the current thrive of CPU speeds during,
yes,
that time?
Yes. So as the CPU speed kept going up and up, you can think that the computation is getting done faster. So now how can I do the communication faster so that there will be good overlap of computation and communication? If I cannot achieve that, yeah, then the communication becomes the bottleneck,
yep,
and then you don't get effective parallel, yeah, speed up.
And the interconnects at the time, they were not as standardized and
no,
there was no winner, so to speak?
No, Ethernet was there. I mean, it has been there for many years. But then in the late 80s or the early 90s, people found out that the processor speed is going so fast, we need some other different network. That's how like fiber channel started.
Mm, right.
There was a network called ATM, asynchronous transfer mode.
Mm-hmm.
And then Myrinet was the first network which tries to come up in a commodity manner.
Mm-hmm.
Saying anybody can go and buy a newer network, and that network was customized, not going through like the TCP, IPv, the traditional kernels, but trying to use some user level protocols and make that communication faster.
Mm-hmm.
So and if
it was
I have
pushing messages, like were MPI a thing back then?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, that was like the... Prior to MPI, this was like a late, early 80s, and a lot of parallel systems were there.
Mm-hmm.
Like there used to be connection machine, there used to be a mass power machine, but everybody had their own stack.
Mm-hmm.
These were proprietary stacks. So what was happening is, if you buy a Cray machine, your application cannot move to another machine.
Mm.
Okay, so this is where people started asking, can we come up with some standard? And the initial standard was actually PVM, Parallel Virtual Machine,
mm-hmm.
PVM. That was like the precursor of MPI.
Okay.
And then, then the people saw a lot of limitations in the PVM. People tried to come up with some kind of a standardization so that if my application, I try to run on that specification, it can be portable.
Yeah, but maybe to back up a little, this PVM was the problem they tried to solve was having a process or a program running on multiple distributed processes and let them keep the same memory space, or
it was a distributed memory, but it was trying to decouple the underlying hardware mm-hmm. or the networker from the applications.
Yeah.
Okay. So if I have parallelized my application and it is running on a PVM environment, then any kind of newer platforms providing that PVM environment, that application can run.
But the guarantee PVM gave was, or the abstraction was, that you save something in a variable and it will be available on another processor?
No. It was basically assuming that you have distributed data. Mm-hmm. How do I communicate? Like the send operation, receive operation,
I'm
synchronization operation. How do you exchange information?
Ah, okay. So it was like MPI is also like a message passing protocol.
Yes. They also had some client server mode also. Like mm-hmm. you can have a server, multiple clients that they talk to the server.
Mm-hmm.
So that time it was very hot.
Okay.
In fact, if you think the Euro MPI conference, which is the lead MPI conference these days, the many years back, the name used to be Euro PVM / MPI conference.
Okay.
That's where it started. Okay.
This MPI is this underlying framework that allows for messages to pass.
Yes.
Hence the name. So you can have like a chunk of data that you want to scatter to a lot of processors, and then you tell MPI, so move it, and then he will move it.
Move it either point to point or some collectives like a broadcast, all to all, reduce. So those were the primitives which were standardized so that it becomes much more easier for an application developer
mm-hmm.
to distribute the data and then perform the computation.
Yeah, and coordinate, right? Also very important. So
yes.
That the bricklayers, you have a flute, and then you say, okay, now we go to the second layer, and
that's
now
correct.
We go to the third layer, so
yes.
that everyone is coordinated. And this is like, what do you say, mid-90s?
MPI standard, I think, I may need to double check, but I think it was 92 or 93.
Though
it was like the discussion started coming. And I think the first MPI 1 was standardized in 1996. I may need to double check the
name. Yeah, I mean, not the details are not so very important. So, and looking back, so this was the first step to make it easier to create programs, right? You have a standard that you can develop against.
Yes.
And you don't care about the underlying...
That's true.
...interconnect anymore.
Yes.
And then the interconnect became a problem. And then InfiniBand started.
Yes. Because you can still run a parallel program. That's how the Beowulf cluster started. It was like a called networks of workstations. So that means I can distribute the work in my lab where everybody is using their own individual workstations, but I can put them together as a parallel computing platform.
Yeah.
Okay. So the program will run, but the question is, are you getting the parallel speed up?
Yeah.
And that is the direction in which the field is moving. Especially if the application sizes are increasing, people want to solve all kinds of grand challenge problems, we need to make sure that the communication is not a bottleneck.
Mm.
And so that is coming from the hardware networking layer, also the MPI implementations of those over those networks. Yeah. So both of these would need to work together so that the MPI layer doesn't bring a lot of overhead, and then the applications can directly run and take advantage of it.
Mm. And MPI is predominant with C, C++, Fortran?
This is how it started. Fortran has been there. People have also running C, C++, but nowadays you see Python binding. Yeah. A lot of people are also...
Python is quite old, actually, right? This Python binding, I think?
Yeah, but MPI. Over the years, people have been using some of the applications with MPI.
But there's no JavaScript library yet.
Java, I think it is there. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think all different kinds of bindings are there.
Yeah.
So
I'm looking forward to a Go one, but that's my personal thing. Yeah. So okay, cool. So we have API or PVM, MPI, and then I guess the interconnect was not catching up fast enough. So they thought, okay, let's do it from scratch and make us a consortium and not individual vendors, so that we have more control over it. And was Mellanox a thing back then? Were they the original founders?
Yeah, in fact, InfiniBand Consortium, there were a lot of lead organizations in the InfiniBand specifications. Intel, Microsoft, I think HP, DEC used to be there. Mellanox, I don't think, was a lead vendor at that time. But
what,
they
what
were
did they
still
do
there.
Before InfiniBand?
No, they were doing, but they were participating in the standardization, but it was led by some of the top leaders, top industry leaders. And then it gradually expanded into a lot of industry. There were a lot of InfiniBand vendors also. Mm-hmm. Gradually, like a lot of startups came into the picture, trying to design InfiniBand adapter. QLogic was one, Voltaire was one. I think there were several of them.
Mm.
Then gradually some kind of consolidation took place. Mellanox and Voltaire got merged. QLogic was acquired by Intel. So like this, some reshuffling took place.
And this was the two grooves, right? One was offload, one was onload.
Yes.
But maybe not sure if you want to go down that road.
I can cover it. So whenever you do the communication, so the question is, who is doing the communication? I call it like a executive versus secretary. Typically, if you think there is an executive who wants to offload a lot of things to the secretary so that the executive time is left to do the actual decision making. Mm-hmm. That's what we see in the common organizations.
So he doesn't have to apply the stamp. He doesn't have to label the envelope.
That's
correct.
Just
been done by the secretary.
And that's what Mellanox has been doing over the years. The QLogic philosophy is tied up with somehow the multi-core evolution. So the idea was that if I have so many cores, do all the cores need to run computation, or can I use some cycles of some cores or some dedicated cores for communication?
Yeah, if you have enough executives, then
give some executives to do the communication. So that is the very high level separation of these two principles.
Yeah, and as we said earlier, since we have multi cores now, and you predict like in a couple of years we have 100 cores, then this might be a direction to go.
Yes, I mean, there have been a lot of studies. There is pluses and minuses both on these. There is a performance and there is a cost. Okay. So the question is, just like executive secretary, you can see executive salary is very high. Secretary salary need not be very high. So if you put them together, are you providing a good cost performance? The same thing you can also ask in a multi-core environments. Just like you said, if I have a lot of executives, I am taking some of the executives to do the communication, but their salaries are high. So is it cost effective?
Yeah.
Instead of like doing the communication, they could be doing computation.
Yeah.
Okay.
And maybe to squeeze out or break this analogy a little bit, or maybe not. And the Mellanox part is offloading, right?
Yes, yes.
And one could think of, if the secretaries are all connected and they are super smart on the secretary network, so that one secretary takes work from another one to go to another secretary's office.
Yes,
so
yes.
What they call collectives.
Offload, Core Logic. Now they have a SARP. SARP, that is the latest one, which is like what you are mentioning. The secretaries can work together or together with their network.
Yeah.
To implement efficient collective operations.
Yeah, that one secretary goes from building to building and says, here, tomorrow at 9, and he doesn't have to go to every executive and tell it
yes.
to him, but
yes.
just spreads it to the secretary
or
Facebook.
The executive doesn't have to move. Executives can talk to each other also.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's interesting how this will pan out. But yeah, I mean, yeah, that we covered that. And MPI, as we said, is not only message passing, but also communication, mm-hmm. which is, I mean, communication, the definition is passing messages, I guess. So, but coordination and communication,
yes,
maybe
that's
more. What was it where I wanted to go? Escapes me. No. Let me cheat. I have to look at my cheat. Something intelligent I wanted to say. right. Yeah, exactly. So now we have all this commoditized HPC gear, or more commoditized HPC gear. So you can buy it for not as super expensive anymore as it used to be. And now you come in and take this gear and tell the struggling non-HPC guys, look, Hadoop or the Java frameworks you use, they are all based on the premise we have brittle networks, mm-hmm. we have high latency, maybe throughput
low
is
bandwidth.
Okay,
yeah.
But the network is not good. And if you look into your stack and then take it apart and put in all the cool Formula One gear that we have in HPC, we can speed it up. So,
yes.
And this is...
I mean, that's what actually my group has been doing. If you have been seeing, besides the MPI project, I have a project on the big data. We call it high performance big data. So we have taken a lot of these features of InfiniBand and traditional Hadoop and the new Spark. So we have designed efficient middleware so that all these Hadoop Spark applications can take advantage of these modern networks in a transparent manner.
Yeah, in a smart way, right?
In a smart manner.
I mean, the not to say stupid, but the first iteration was, let's do TCP over IP. IB.
IP over IB.
IP over IB, exactly.
Yes. But
which,
now our stacks can run on InfiniBand Verfs, okay?
Mm, yeah.
So in fact, even within our research, now we have gone into the second stage. So in the first stage, we just wanted to accelerate, okay?
Mm.
But now what we are seeing is, if you can accelerate the lower layer, you can actually rethink the upper layer designs.
Can you take apart like IB over IP over IB and IB verbs? Like,
mm-hmm.
like only the brief overview, what's the difference?
Yeah, yeah. So IP over IB is a emulation of TCP IP over InfiniBand. It has been there for many years. Instead of running the TCP IP over the Ethernet, you can run it in the InfiniBand hardware, but it still goes through the kernel. That's
mm-hmm.
why it has the kernel overhead. It takes advantage of the bandwidth for large messages, but it encounters latency. Okay,
yeah.
On the native InfiniBand, this is where the user space communication takes place. So you don't have to go through operating system or the kernel every time you send the data. There are some initialization steps. As long as you take care of that in the beginning part of the execution, data can move very efficiently with
mm-hmm.
low latency and high bandwidth.
So you don't get a post office, but you get the horse.
Yes.
And then you can put whatever you want on the
that's
horse.
That's correct. Yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah.
Okay. So and you put on this native IB verb, so this native communication is called IB
yes,
verbs.
Yes.
And you put it into the frameworks like Java Netty.
Java Native Interface, the JNI layer. So from the JNI layer, we take it to the basic native InfiniBand.
Yeah.
Okay. So we see good performance and scalability there.
Yeah, and not only with InfiniBand, but also with Rocky, right?
Yes, we support that also.
So Rocky is RDMA over converged Ethernet, right?
Yes.
And it's coming, right? I mean, I haven't seen it that much, but...
No, I think a lot of deployments are taking place. Those people want to stick with Ethernet switches. Mm-hmm. This is where the Rocky is coming into the picture. So the way I abstract it, it is, you can think of it's like InfiniBand software running with Ethernet hardware.
Yeah, and they are very close anyways, right? Well, nowadays, you can buy a Mellanox switch and it's both.
Both, yes. Yeah.
And Rookie, can you do it on 1 gigabit Ethernet as well? Or is it one meg? When
I don't think it is there for 1 gigi.
But 10 gig is the minimum?
I think if you see the InfiniBand speeds, like DDR, QDR, FDR, so you can take one of those speeds.
Okay, so you have to, the DDR was 20 gig? 16
gigabits. 20, but there it has some overhead.
Right.
So 16 gig. Or QDR is 32, FDR is 56. And EDR is 100. So for those speeds, we have the Rocky available.
And is it much cheaper than InfiniBand, by the way?
I don't think so.
It's not much cheaper.
You can check with Mellanox, but but it's the same hardware. The adapter is the same. It is just the internal firmware has been modified so that the same hardware can work like a native InfiniBand or like a Rocky.
But the competition must be higher, so maybe it's a little bit cheaper. But what do I know about economics? But somehow,
like the cost overall deployment of the system, you're saying?
No, I mean if you have the same hardware and you can run 40 gig, Ethernet or 40 gig InfiniBand. There are a lot of other 40 gig vendors for Ethernet, but there's only one for InfiniBand. So maybe the price will be a little bit lower.
There are all different cost structures are there for different size of the systems. Mm-hmm. So if you just like for a small scale system, you may not see much difference. But for a larger scale system, I think you should be able to see the clear difference. Okay, but at least the Rocky is allowing people to have flexibility so that they can go either pure Ethernet switches or InfiniBand switches, but still get advantage of all the RDMA-enabled software.
Mm-hmm. And you made it open source, right? All this
The MHAPH is open source. That is the MPI stack. On the big data side, it's not open source. It's publicly available. Anybody can use it. We have some plugin modules also, but it's not open source yet because we are still actively doing the development.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. And you do it for Hadoop?
We have Spark. We also have for Memcached. That is the component which gets used in the data centers. So there also we have done similar kind of things.
Kafka already as well?
Kafka is on the way.
I think we talked about it at Stanford, right?
We just had a paper accepted. So see in few months, we'll have an RDMA version for Kafka.
Ooh. And Rookie at the same... Oh, it's same RDMA, you said. Yes, so it's both.
InfiniBand and Rocky, both of them will be there.
Cool. I like Kafka.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Maybe something, I mean, that's some group that we didn't talk about, but it's implicit from the non-HPC part is the financial guys, right?
Mm-hmm.
They are also big benefiter from all this HPC gear coming around.
HPC technology has a lot of implication. Of course, the financial trading companies, they have a lot of requirements for performance, but their requirements are a little bit different. In the sense, for them, or think of like HPC, traditional scientific applications, reliability is very important, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That means if a packet gets dropped, I need to take care of it is at the upper layer. Whereas in the financial, they can afford losing packets But for them, timeliness is important.
Yeah.
Like a stock ticker code, if you few packets get dropped, in the next minute or so, you can get the new sticker stock. But the challenge is how to push those sticker stock efficiently to all the clients so that the actual stock exchanges can take place.
And it's not about bandwidth, it's more about the poor latency.
Latency also matters. That's why the timeliness. So in fact, there are proprietary stacks from even Mirinet, some of the other like Emulex. So what they have done, instead of going through the TCP/IP route, you know, UDP stack is also there. They have tried to accelerate the UDP stack with RDMA.
Okay.
And those stacks are actually getting used in the financial markets.
And isn't there this UC connection type in InfiniBand?
There was. I mean, it is there. It is not supported completely. Okay. But UD has been there, unreliable datagram. In the pure InfiniBand side, over in the Ethernet, UDP has been there for many years. So UDP can afford to lose packets, but performance were not great. So this is where these people like Mirinet and Emulex, they have gone and tried to bring all the latest things like the user level RDMA, those on the under the hood, so that you get very good performance with the UDP layer.
So Mirinet is still around?
They have been transformed. I think for last few years they are under a new name. I don't remember now. They have been acquired by another company. They are still working a lot on the 10 gigi, the traditional Ethernet thing, not in the traditional HPC. They are no longer there.
Okay. But is there something? I mean, maybe I'm. But with TCP over or IP over IB? No, right. Then it's UDP over IB is also a thing.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So the future. We all. It's coming.
Sure.
I touched on it a little bit, and maybe we can dip into it again a little bit. That my network engineer friends at my peer group, they told me once, and it resonated with me, that the network is becoming so reliable no matter what network you have, that this brittleness of TCP is gone, and with Rookie you have all the cool things at hand, and you can use this reliable Ethernet-based network, and then use the RDMA for other things. And I mean, you do a lot of good work with as we said, Hadoop, Memcache, and Kafka. Do you see others trying to accelerate other frameworks as well?
Yeah. I mean, so there's a lot of work going on with a similar kind of philosophy, like TensorFlow. A lot of people are now accelerating all the deep learning framework like CAFE, CNTK. We are doing some of these things ourselves. In fact, I have a new project for the last 2 years called High Performance Deep Learning. Okay, just like what we did with the big data, we are trying to do similar kind of things for the deep learning frameworks. But other people like Baidu, NVIDIA, a lot of other companies are trying to follow very similar approaches. Saying these stacks, how do we take advantage of the underlying network and their features to accelerate?
But for this, the discipline has to be mature a little bit, right? I mean, I haven't used much machine learning yet, but it seems to me that this is moving very fast. You try to underpin it with something, once you finish it, then there are three other frameworks out there.
Yes. So that's why it is a lot of big competition out there within all these groups. We have to see, might be in another 1 year or two, we'll see which ones succeed and which one don't.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, true.
But the idea is the same, philosophy is the same. So they are talking about scale up and scale out. Mm-hmm. Those are the terminologies they are using. The scale up, the traditional data center saying within the node, I have to start using all the cores, do efficient.
Buy a bigger IBM machine.
Yeah, like a single node. Yeah. Single node with a lot of cores. Yeah. In fact, NVIDIA has this DGX machine, mm-hmm, having 8 GPUs. So they want to scale up first. Yeah. And once you get good performance, then go out, scale out, so that you can actually utilize a lot of GPUs, a lot of cores.
And this beast is crazy, right? This NVIDIA thing. But yes. It costs $130,000, I think.
I know.
Crazy, sorry.
And yes. Yes. Yeah.
And it has like 400 gigabit InfiniBand to feed it.
Yes.
So you need a pile of data to feed it. Like, crazy. Boggles my mind.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to ask tomorrow if I can take one home. Yeah. Maybe not. Yeah, cool. So there's a lot of fuss in all kinds of high performance disciplines. So we have computing, the traditional one, big data.
Yeah.
The one in the last 10 years, give or take.
Yes.
And now we have machine learning, which is big data in another level.
Another level, yes.
Or intelligence, big data.
There are different things. You can think of like AI is the broader domain. Then mm-hmm. there is a machine learning. Within that machine learning, there is a deep learning. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there is some hierarchy. But in all those fields, they are just desperate for HPC-like things to be used so that they can start exploring larger data set, a very quick training, and then the quick decision making, those kind of things.
I think that never changes, right?
No.
It was
no.
the same 30 years ago, I guess.
Yes, yes.
You give them bigger machines, they come up with bigger problems.
Yes.
When
yes.
will it stop?
Yes.
Maybe it won't.
No, in fact, along this line, I just also want to indicate for the last 1.5 years, I have been actually involved with another project, neuroscience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are crazy
brain,
for compute.
Brain. People are trying to come up or understand how the brains work. So, in fact, recently we worked with some neuroscience researchers from Indiana University. So they have a model that was only running sequentially.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually worked with them, tried to parallelize that. And even on a single node, we are able to give them a speed up of 8, 10.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and they want to grow. They want to, mm-hmm. instead of processing one brain, they want to process 1,000 brains.
Yeah.
So,
and this biologist, they are the craziest.
They are the
bunch,
craziest,
right?
Yes.
Because I studied with bioinformatics, and it seems that this is the fastest moving field, in my opinion, or to some degree, because they hack something together, and I don't want to like put blame on them, but it's understandable. They have frameworks, they are very fast iterating, so they put something together, then they put another framework on it, and then it's a bunch of frameworks put together, and half a year later it's very hard to do it again, because all the frameworks have moved from version 0.5 to 0.8 and nothing works together anymore. So there needs to be a little bit consolidation somehow, but it's hard.
No, so in fact this this coming closer to what you do, containers. In fact, that is exactly the container technology is becoming very useful for them. So they can design all these things, put everything together in a container, and you can just run it. Even if some packages got changed, you don't have to get stuck. You can
keep on
moving. And then over a period of time, all these the modules will again get updated. So in fact, those are the biggest users of container technology.
Yeah, that's true, because they're desperate.
They're desperate. Yeah, they're desperate. And if you manually want to build these things, it takes days.
Yeah.
I did
a little project with a friend of mine from university, and I containerized his framework, which was a DNA sequencing analytics framework. which you don't want to install, where because you have to have R and C and PyPy, and
that's correct.
Know, that's what's crazy.
Correct.
Yeah. Right. I did want to like it. It was not a hook to get to containers. I think we will talk about containers tomorrow.
We landed up there.
No.
Yeah.
So. And. Serverless, I mean, I have to talk about serverless, I think, a little bit, which is also a little pivot to containers, but I didn't want to go down this route. But
sure.
For me, maybe let's call it, not call it serverless, but hosted functions. I think that's something that's also very coming, right? It's Kafka in little pieces, basically, where you trigger, as you said before, like you have an MRI image, and this can be handled by a single function to do one-step process. Processing, and then it will be handled over to another server or function, and this does another thing. And all these different functions, they are only one-time things. So you shoot it one time, they process it, and then they pass it on. Yeah. And they are pretty much TCP based nowadays.
Yes.
Do you think this is something where you could? Maybe no. Yeah, maybe you have to wait until it matures.
Yes. But gradually it'll come. So the broadly you can see it's like a workflow. Mm. I mean, just like different functions, the data keeps moving. Now the question is how large is the data and how much results you are moving from one function to the other function.
Okay.
If those are not high, then the current generation systems or TCP IPv will be good, but very soon, if these workflows work well, these people will try to increase their data size, make the functions more sophisticated. So then you will see a big demand of the data movement from one step to the other.
Yeah.
And inherently at that time, if you are not using high performance networks or protocols, things will get choked.
That's when they started to show up at your doorstep.
Yes.
But is it, I mean, that's a very dynamic and setup, right? You have a lot of functions, like let's say thousands of functions appearing and disappearing and reappearing again. So do you think that you can squeeze InfiniBand into it? Because you need to make up connections first because you can move information, right? It's not an ad hoc network so much.
Multiple things are happening. InfiniBand has the new transport. I don't know whether you know, called DCT, Dynamic Connect. So in fact, it has been there for the last 2 years. So there used to be the traditional RC UD, and then XRC was introduced, but now the focus is on this DCT. Or sometimes it is just called DC. So the idea is that you just give data to the adapter. Adapter establishes connection, transfers the data, and may take it out. Mm-hmm. It waits for some time. If no further data is coming, I can just terminate that and move the things to the other. Mm-hmm. Other.
And this copes with the problem that if you have like 10,000 nodes and everyone might communicate with everyone else, then everyone needs to have the connection open.
Yes.
And this surprisingly eats up a lot of memory, right?
Yeah, that's exactly. So in fact, we did a very detailed study. We have published in some of the recent conferences because if you purely do RC, there are so many connections and every connection requires memory. So your footprint of the MPI library goes up significantly. Whereas the DC will try to cut it down significantly.
And this is offloading and unloading both?
Or no, is it? This is pure InfiniBand. We have done with the Mellanox. So you can think of it as like an offload. The adapter is taking a decision.
Yeah. And in the unload mode, the CPU has to take this decision somehow.
No.
Or is it implemented in the...
It is implemented in the adapter.
In both?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
then I could have a network of whatever amount of nodes and I could have a standing connection or dynamic connection. And if I don't care where it's computed, then I can just even hand it down and say, okay, send it to some open connections you already have established.
Yeah.
So it could be round robin. So you don't need to specify where it should be computed.
I think those are the internal algorithms Mellanox has. Those are not public. Okay. How you change, up to what time you wait. So they just provide you some API so that the data is being delivered without any penalty or without keeping the connection open for the entire execution.
But do I need to have an MPI domain that is standing, or can I just
We have supported our MAPPIC library, MPI library with that. We made the release like last year. So end applications don't have to worry about it. Okay. Just using our MPI library, the underlying communication happens with the DC mode. But the same concept, you can take it to any other middleware.
I just architecting my serverless InfiniBand boosted application in containers, to be fair. So it would be a single application coming up, mm-hmm. connecting to InfiniBand.
Okay.
So can I connect to an already existing MPI domain? So imagine you have five hosts or five containers. They're mm-hmm. all coming up after another. Can okay. they build the same MPI domain? And then once one did work, dropped out, and then another container takes his place, can he then join the same MPI domain? Or do I have to do it differently?
I think theoretically it is feasible, but we may need to talk to see the lower interfaces and what they're exactly asking for, or whether there is a mismatch between the MPI semantics and the containers requirements. Mm. But I think it should be doable. It should be doable.
Mm. A pet project for the winter, maybe.
Okay.
Okay, cool. I think we covered a lot. If you even covered serverless, so we covered a lot of stuff. Do you think I don't want to go into the container route today. Maybe that's something for another day.
Sure.
Because we talked of almost an hour already. So do you think we missed something significantly?
No, I don't think so. We covered a lot of things for the last 30 to 40 years. Yeah,
we kind of talked about PGAS.
PGAS we didn't talk. So the broad idea here is people have been using MPI. MPI, as you know, traditionally started with a two-sided communication. Over the MPI 2 introduced one-sided. That means I can do put mm-hmm. or get operations, but they were not very efficient. Synchronization had some overhead. So then the MPI 3 tried to revive that one-sided model.
What was one-sided and two-sided again?
Yeah. So the traditional two-sided is that I do a send, you receive.
Mm-hmm.
That means both parties need to be involved.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, right.
MPI 2 introduced this one-sided model. That means I can do a put to your memory. You don't have to be actively involved.
But I have to declare memory to be used by you.
There are some semantics. You have to define a window. Then this process puts. It says, okay, start the window operation, end the window operation. But the idea is that the receiver doesn't have to be totally mm-hmm. involved. There are a lot of different synchronization semantics.
He just says, I have storage area. No matter, you can use it. I will not look at it. So you can just
put it. When I need it, I'll come.
Yeah.
Okay. But the MPI 2, the whole design was heavy weighted. So it was not giving good performance. So MPI 3 went and tried to rewrite that. Mm-hmm. And then it has a reasonably good APIs and also implementations. But still, some people find it a little bit hard. Like if you go to the application developers, they find it hard to use the RMA semantics because there are so many underlying, unless you do it very properly, your applications will not run mm-hmm. correctly. Okay. So while this was going on, then this other community, which is called the PGAS community, like the partitioned global address space. So that has been evolving over the years. There are different players, or there are some sub-communities, like there is a OpenSMEM, then there is a UPC, then there is a UPC++, CoRA, Fortran. So like this, people are trying to take a similar objective, but do it in a little bit differently. And the reason being, how we can provide good productivity to the application developer, okay?
Make it easy
so that this is the, as the name says, it is a partitioned global address space. So that means the memory is still distributed, but it is trying to provide a logical shared memory.
Mm-hmm.
But no cache coherence, okay? It's mm-hmm. a logical shared memory. Anybody can read and write to its other's memory, okay? Mm-hmm. And that becomes especially helpful for your applications if the application has irregular communication, has load balancing issues. So those kind of things are easier to handle with a PGAS-like or a one-sided semantics instead of two-sided.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So what would be an example of this application?
Yeah, so think of like many times, I think this happens with some of the, like let's say, molecular dynamics, astronomy applications. Like I did some computation, then the data is in some places, but then the computation requirements changes. That mm-hmm. means this data on this memory, more and more people need to mm-hmm. operate on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Or it is, you can think of like a multi-scale computation. So I finished one scale, the next scale, the load balancing is very different.
Ah, so okay? it's Wild West and you cannot predict it
yes.
in beforehand, so you yeah. cannot... Yeah,
you cannot write the MPI program in advance saying how the data will proceed.
Mm.
Whereas here in the PGAS or even in the MPI 3 RMA model, you can achieve this. So mm-hmm. at some phase, then this data, I can say, okay, now instead of 5 processes operating, now let's 10 processes operate. So mm-hmm. all of them can get data.
And under the hood, the information will be pushed around by MPI without you writing MPI code?
It's not information. Like somebody is still doing it, but MPI being a two-sided, you may need to exchange a lot of additional information
mm-hmm.
before that phase can start.
Yeah.
Okay. Whereas in the PGAS, because everybody has access to each other's memory, it is much more easier.
Mm.
For like one iteration to finish and the second iteration to start.
Yeah. Okay. And you are not optimal with your if you would write it in MPI 3 like natively, then it would be much faster, or not yes. much faster, but it would be faster. But you have this this carelessness of
yes.
using PGAS.
Yes.
So you don't need to be optimal all the time. If you're 95% optimal, it's good enough.
Yeah, I mean, one is performance, then the other one is productivity, as yeah. I said, the productivity. Yeah. So yeah. So that is the PGAS model. Writing this kind of applications are much more easier mm-hmm. than if you go through the MPI 3 RMA. Performance-wise, if you do equal effort, you will get similar performance.
Mm. Okay.
Okay,
cool. So maybe I want to touch a little bit on containers, because
sure.
Tomorrow I will talk about it. And
sure.
What always puzzles me is that it's hard for me to use MPI run with containers, because if I use it natively, like MPI run without using Slurm or any workshops scheduler, that helps a little bit. I need to have SSH on the other side, right? Because and correct me if I'm wrong, but I perceived it as you do MPI run,
mm-hmm.
you instantiate a process on your host. First, you create this ordd communication network, right? So you start this communication daemon.
Mm-hmm.
What is ordd standing for? Do you know what it's?
Ordd.
Yeah.
Ordd.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is the OpenMPI runtime.
Ah.
In the OpenMPI.
So that makes sense.
Yeah.
So this instantiates this this OpenMPI runtime, and then the process of my program will start. And it's all starting using, I mean, you can configure it, but it's all starting by invoking it via SSH, right? And I wonder what it would take to kick out this SSH connection and tell the process or the MPI run command, look, SSH is not anymore there. Let's say you connect to this Docker engine or whatever engine and start the process. And since instead instantiating it as an SSH user, just instantiating a container somewhere else. I guess it's deep in the weeds.
Yeah, yeah. You see, there are traditionally, like any MPI, like MPI run is a little bit higher level. So below that, I mean, different MPI libraries do different things. There is also a lot of work taking place called PMI exchange.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a like our MBAP Institute library uses that. All other MPI library also have started using this. Now there is a lot of discussions to go to PMIX. Okay, so the whole idea is that before you start your parallel/distributed program, at some level a node has to know, like an adapter has to know whom to send. Okay, so that is a requirement.
Sure.
How you do it and how efficiently you do, these are the different solutions. Okay, like you can do with a RT model, you can go through a PMI model. It may come at some very low level SSH kind of things. So as the system sizes are increasing, there is a lot of focus taking place on along those directions also.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think of like a 10 million core system. How do you start? How do you start a job? Okay.
Yeah.
So that is a big challenge. And we have been in our group also have been focusing a lot on those kind of MPI job startup. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, tomorrow morning I'll show you some numbers on very latest Stampede 2.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to start like 235,000 processes. I think it is less than 25 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So
similar kind of things, we need to see how do we move it into the container environment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for me, the problem I always encounter is that you need to create a container first and then you can run something, right? I will show a little demo tomorrow where I spin up like four containers and then I do a little MPI ring
communication
example. Like I have four processes, they are pushing data around, and at the end everyone is killed. And
yes,
you see, okay, that's host name from the first container, that's host name from the second, and so on. But it's okay. I mean, you can do it like that. If you use Slurm, then you just use the Slurm daemon within the container and you don't use SSH anymore, so that's a little bit better. But still, I need to start the container first, then I need to start Slurm in there, and then I can run something. But what I want to do is, the cool thing about containers is that the user land is could be stripped down, could be optimized for different use cases, and you can go crazy on tweaking libc or whatever libraries you use. But you don't want to spin it up with Slurm. You want Slurm to spin up, or the process should be started within the container without being inside of the container before, if this sounds coherent. But you know, because now you start a container, then Slurm has to run in it. And what I want to have is I want five nodes all running Slurm, and then I tell Slurm, run this job for me, this container you need to start, and then it instantiates the container, and there's only the process that is the computation process within the container. Because now I have to take care of the Slurm installation in the user land of the container.
Okay.
That's my dream.
Okay. So I think we did some work from our group. Were you there in the Slurm user meeting last year?
I don't think so.
Okay. Maybe I'll send you some pointers. We presented something. How do you bring the Slurm and container together? Or we can do some offline discussion and see if those kind of solutions can help you in your project kind of thing.
Yeah. And I will bump the Slurm guys again. I mean, now I have a bigger name behind me, so...
Okay.
With Sony, they were not interested. Maybe Docker rings a bell for them.
Okay.
So. But yeah. Cool. Okay. Thanks, DK.
Thank
you. It was
a
pleasure. One hour, 20 minutes. We are
it was a pleasure also. Okay.
Cool. Thanks. And yeah, everyone. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And I will record another one, I think, tomorrow, Mitzi. And yeah, cool.
Thank you.
Thanks, DK.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.